Welcome once again to Replacement Level Morality. My name is Joseph.
My name's Andrew.
You know what we should do, Andrew, before we launch into our first topic?
What's that?
We should explain why we named our podcast Replacement Level Morality. I think we've done enough episodes that if you've stuck around this long, you might be interested.
So I was kind of thinking that we would wait for someone to ask, because it's such an obvious question. I was like, when someone comments, why is it called Replacement Level Morality? That was going to be my cue to do it, but we can go now.
No, you know what? I like your plan better. It's going to be a mystery until someone asks.
Okay. All right.
I like that plan. And now we've put it out there. So, you know, the longer it goes on that no one asks, the more depressed we can become at our lack of engagement. Although you're very engaging on Twitter, by the way. Replace Level Pod. Replace Level Pod is our Twitter handle, and you are quite the master there. I've enjoyed watching you work.
Thank you. I've been doing my best.
And we try to, you know, find the line between fun and informative takes. Andrew has what I would call the informative take of the week. I've got the fun take of the week. And that fun is on a particular political lolcow of a vintage I have wanted to crack open for some time. And that is Robert Francis O'Rourke, better known to the voting public as Beto. Beto!
All I know about him is he's a furry.
Yeah, so, Beto O'Rourke, one of the two members of the class of 2018 that never won anything, part of the gang who couldn't shoot straight, him and Stacey Abrams. I find him to be a particular fascinating political figure because of how he represents modern political leadership in the worst way possible.
Okay.
We come from a generation, myself and yourself, the gap in our ages kind of puts us in different generational cohorts, I think, practically speaking, because I'm more Gen X aligned, late millennial, and you're more Zoomer aligned, you know, early yeah. millennial. Both of us have this problem where the emerging leadership, political leadership that are in our cohorts, they are a people born of absolutely zero suffering, zero like genuine danger in their lives of any kind, no adversity needed to be overcome by any of these people. They are almost exclusively born to money. So it isn't even they had like low-level economic struggles in the early part of their lives and found success later. They are truly the scions of themselves of privileged elite who just remained elite and untouched until they decided it was time for them to lead others. This is not how political leadership has been formed in the past.
No, I hear they sometimes go on bombing raids.
Yeah, like even the rich elite of the World War II generation went to war, right? John F. Kennedy was one of many Kennedy children who all came from this, you know, Brahmin family in Massachusetts. None of them needed to go, but they all did. They all fought. Some of them died.
A lot of them are like officers, but there's still the sense of like there was not a warrior class the way there is now.
Yeah, like they were certainly they were elevated beyond mere meat for the grinder pouring out of PT boats on D-Day or whatever, but they still fought. They still put themselves in danger. They still did, in some cases, very heroic things. Like George H.W. Bush was a freaking Avenger pilot. He was like a torpedo bomber pilot trying to sink Japanese ships. Like, he's out there doing shit. Like, even if his dad was Prescott Bush and a senator, right? He doesn't need to be doing that stuff, but he did it. Because he had an obligation to do so.
And noblesse oblige is yes, a phrase that's been on my mind a lot lately.
Same here. And if you want noblesse oblige coming to a sort of decadent end, I think it can be found in the person of Robert Francis O'Rourke. And that's why I find him so fascinating.
So Beto O'Rourke, when I think of him, what I think of before you launch into your rant, and I'm going to let that go. So I'm just going to set the stage a little bit. So I make sure I talk at some point in this half hour.
Of course, as you should.
What I know about Beto is he is kind of the exemplar of bad incentives. He ran as this moderate in 2018 and then completely pivoted to try to take the left flank of Bernie from the culture war side in the 2020 primary, and lost that fight, very unsurprisingly, but not before giving us such wonderful sound bites as tax the churches and hell yeah, we're going to take your AR-15. And then tried to run again in Texas and Pikachu face.
And then lost to Greg Abbott, who is not popular, but he still got crushed by him. Like, Greg Abbott oversaw, like, the terrible Uvalde shooting and, like, multiple power outages and just, like, bad shit happened in Texas that no one liked over the last 4 years. There was certainly a window where someone could have stepped in and said, I can run the state better than this guy. And instead of someone credible emerging into that environment, you had a guy who had so thoroughly discredited himself to the small C conservative voters of Texas that even he could not possibly serve as that stand-in, as the I will be the competent managerial person that you wish to turn to run this state. His political failure, I think, is the best known part of him, right? Like, because that's the part we all got to watch.
It's all very condensed. It was in 4 years.
Yeah, it was a very quick story arc because he came onto the scene because he ran a close race against the world's least likable man and almost beat him by essentially being a center-left Democrat in Texas. And that can work and has worked in the past. And they just thought that he had captured some secret sauce by almost winning in Texas because Democrats are addicted. They're addicted to winning Texas.
They're addicted to almost winning Texas.
Yes. Yes. They're like, Texas is going purple. It's going blue. We're going to do it this year. And every year it's like, man, we lost by 8. What could possibly have happened? Like, every time. And so, like, they got within a couple points of beating the world's least likable man, Ted Cruz. And they're like, oh, this is it. This is the sauce. This Beto O'Rourke guy, he's going to be the one to lead us there. And then he heard that and was like, yeah, I am. And then he decided to run for president. I'm like, no, wait, bro, don't do that. Like, why are you doing that? Why would you want to do that? Researching why he did, understanding where this guy's life went and why he thought he could run for president. It all kind of ties the room together when you think about, you know, are we kind of in the decadent phase of empire, you know,
the man set out to single-handedly prove wrong the idea that there is no downside to running for president. Turns out there is a downside, but only if you say really dumb things.
So Beto O'Rourke was, as I intimated, born into privilege, into the most intense privilege. His dad was extremely wealthy. His entire family was essentially gooned up in local government, you know, county commissioner, county judge, like all those kinds of very important offices because Texas government is so localized. So and this is the case in a lot of the South where like the Texas governor isn't all that powerful. It's because all of these powers kind of filter down into sheriff and judge and commissioner roles instead, which makes sense for a very, you know, parochial kind of place like Texas. And so because of that, he was able to fuck around and never find out, right? Like you're talking about dude got a DUI. He like trespassed with his ne'er-do-well punk rock friends at, you know, a local university. And then you never faced really any consequences for any of this stuff because he was the son of the local strongman, right? The local rich businessman who also dabbled in local politics when it suited him. And from there, you know, he decides to get into business, except his dad funds his entire business. He was like a young computer hacker in his day. Yeah. You like, we're talking like hackers, like late 90s type of vibe. Cause he's a firm Gen Xer. He was literally in a punk rock band.
That was the movie, right? Hackers.
It was. It aged like frozen wine, which is to say not well. If you've ever seen it. And he starts like this boutique, like digital services company, but it's like really something he's doing because his dad's companies are able to give him work to do as a contractor. So he doesn't really have to build anything to become wealthy in his own right. He just, latches on to the family business and sort of siphons his piece of it out, into his world before deciding he wants to run for city council in El Paso.
City council is, as long as you don't get federally indicted, it's a noble pursuit.
It is, that's definitely the level of government in which I have the most personal experience. And it is the province of rich dilettantes who want something to do, career local government officials who are a special breed, or would-be ladder climbers. So the folks who really think that they've got the juice to try and build a career into larger political office. And this is typically one of those first rungs that you try to climb when you're kind of like in your early 30s, typically.
Okay. So I don't have a ton of experience in this world, but if you're say like Ohio State Democratic Party, like pull from city council for running for state house, is that like a common thing that happens?
Yeah. So what'll happen is you'll land a city council position, maybe you'll be there 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, all depends on like the structure there. And then maybe from there you parlay that into state house somewhere, like house or senate, depending on where. Maybe that's county commissioner time from that point forward, or a larger county position, because a lot of those offices tend to be elected, whether it be sheriff or treasurer or clerk of courts or something like that, to kind of like continue your career. And then as you've built this name and you kind of built your place in the local party apparatus, that might be when you launch into, I'm going to run for the city council. I'm going to run for the U.S. Congress seat for this area, especially if it's held by the opposite party, or someone's going to retire, or someone's just like ossified in the seat. And you feel like there's like an opportunity to pull a sort of insurgency campaign because they've become so, the whole Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez move, where she got into Congress by winning a primary that like 20,000 people voted in because the incumbent wasn't paying any fucking attention. Like, right. That's how she got into Congress. And so you do that, and then maybe there's more. Maybe there's statewide office from that point forward. Maybe there's federal statewide office, run for Senate. You work your way up the chain to your level of competence. Maybe you get picked for a federal appointment, like an undersecretary role. There's all kinds of ways it could go, right? And the first step, some kind of local office, and city council is usually a really easy one, especially at like cities with at-large elections where it's like top nine get elected. You can be the seventh most popular person on an off year, can't you?
Yeah.
We can do it. So that's what he did. He ran for city council, and he did that from 2005 until 2012, where he did all of the classic city council things. Like, you had to worry about city development, and, he's worked gentrifying areas, and, what are you going to do about local crime issues and all that stuff? Pretty normal. And eventually he does what you would expect, what I just described. He makes a play for higher office, and he decides that play, after being on city council for 7 years and almost about to be term limited out, so you're going to make your next move, is to try and unseat a ossified existing Democrat in the El Paso congressional district that had been there for 16 years.
Okay.
He goes for it, and he wins, and it's a solid blue seat, so he's going to win the general no problem. Here's the thing about being a congressman. It sucks. It's the worst job anyone has ever had. It sucks. The thing about being a congressman is that it seems very prestigious. You get an office, a great title, people care staff. About staff. But you're one of nearly 500 foot soldiers from across the country, and you individually have no power. You are a functionary of your party and the impulses of your bureaucratic party leadership within the chamber. That is it. That is all your power is your service into that machine. So that means whatever committees you're on, whatever the party wants to do, because of how the chamber works, you individually mean essentially nothing unless you're one of the senior leadership that's chairing a committee or making real decisions about what's going on with the party and how things are organized. And other than that, you're doing constituent service. You're going to really long and boring committee meetings where like your staff is trying to do like 6 hours of prep and give you a 3-page summary of the fuck you're about to walk into. And you try and get on CNN as much as possible, because what else is there to do? It sucks. It's not a fun job. Like, and it's because the majoritarian nature of the chamber means particularly if you're in the minority, you have nothing to do.
As the resident Justin Amashtan, I have to mention that this is kind of recent and that so much power has been centralized in the speaker specifically. You used to just be able to offer floor amendments because you felt like it. So if you had something, even if you're in the minority, that like, hey, this is a common sense thing we can all agree on. I got this amendment written. Let's all vote on this. You could vote on this specific amendment to pin down the other side if it's something unpopular. You could do some things. Now you just get nothing.
Correct.
You will vote on the leadership. You will vote on the bill that leadership decides that you wanted to vote on.
Correct. And the vote has been prearranged, and your deviance from that prearrangement will come at peril of you getting reelected.
Yep.
They will find someone else to replace you, and they will do it happily. Right.
Or they'll just not give you any money and let you twist if you're in a competitive purple seat.
Right. They're happy to lose to dispose of the disloyal. Like, happy to. So Beto O'Rourke gets elected to Congress in 2012. You know, like that wasn't a great time to be a Democrat congressman.
The shellacking was 2010, right?
It was the key shellacking was in 2010, but he didn't get the House back the entire time.
Right.
So like he was in Congress for a period where he didn't get to do anything from 2012, 2014, and 2016 even.
Mm-hmm.
So he's in the minority party of the House for 3 terms. And like anyone else, he's like, this job completely blows. I need to do something else with my life. I'm going to run for Senate against Ted Cruz. I can beat Ted Cruz. And goes to try and beat Ted Cruz. And, you know, he's trying to take that sort of, well, you know, I'm someone who, if Ted Cruz, if my wife was insulted, I would not do phone calls for that man later on. I'm like, kind of insults his manhood and tries to run to his left of like, you know, it was really in that anti-Trump era when, you know, it was just everyone wanted to be in opposition to Trump as much as possible. And like, and immigrants are great and all of that. And that's where he positioned himself, sort of generically Democrat against an unpopular Republican incumbent. And comes close, but doesn't seal the deal, because in the end, it's still Texas and he's still a Democrat. And so he lost. Here's where I want to pause the story.
Okay.
Like I said, this story arc of how to build your political career makes a lot of sense. But Beto O'Rourke has never lived a normal moment of his life up to this point where we have now finished the 2018 senatorial election and he has lost, right?
He started a business. What's more American than that?
right? And that's how he tells the story, but he doesn't tell the part where his father funded the whole thing. Like, and this was all basically, he went to Columbia for the love of God, right? Like, he's like born into money, born into power, suffers no consequence for his youthful mistakes, gets an Ivy League education that was, I'm certain, not a cent that came out of his wallet for, comes out of that, immediately is gifted a business opportunity that he, you know, dutifully develops enough to himself, you know, have wealth of his own, and then decides that he is prepared to lead men. What about this man's life at all tells you he is prepared to lead men? What has he done to show, I understand what it means to be broke? I understand what it means to have to like wake up with anxiety about what the future holds for me. This man's had no anxiety about his future his whole fucking life.
Allow me to quote the late great J.R.R. Tolkien. The most improper job of any man is bossing other men. Not one in a million is fit for it, and least of all those who seek the opportunity.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways to I mean, that's an artful way of phrasing the people who do not seek leadership are often the ones who are most suited to it, because they understand the power that comes with having to determine the fates of others, and they shy away from that, because to wield that is something particularly has a lot of gravitas, and it scares smart people. And it is, you know, the venial who seek out that opportunity because they think that they deserve to be listened to. And that's what I hate about Beto O'Rourke. Beto O'Rourke ran for president. Beto O'Rourke ran for governor of Texas because he started to believe that the projection onto him as a generational RFK-style leader, literally shit that was said about him, and he's like the second coming of Robert Kennedy, was true. Like, he got high on his own supply and he believed that he was this generational leadership. And I was like, RFK actually like persecuted the mob. You know,
I thought you were going to say RFK actually could win an election.
Well, that too, but like RFK successfully negotiated with his brother us off the precipice of nuclear war with Russia. He was a huge part of that, right? Like, he did things. Like, he demonstrated before he ran for elected office in his own right, including president, that he was a capable leader in times of true crisis, that he was willing to do difficult and unpopular things for the right reasons. He demonstrated leadership qualities that would say to you, even if you did not align with his political priors, you, sir, are someone that I believe could lead this nation.
You take noblesse oblige seriously.
Exactly. And so the Kennedys were rich and privileged, and some of them suffered not a day in their lives. Others certainly did. But even like our Robert Kennedy, who never saw service overseas, still found a way to take that seriously. Right? Teddy, maybe a little less. Maybe he was the one that started, like, maybe he didn't suffer quite enough, except when he got his mistress drowned, perhaps. But, you know, we don't want to say bad things about the deceased. They're not here to defend themselves. Beto is the Gen X millennial problem. There's very few people in the political leadership strata of our age groups that really seem to understand the noblesse oblige question. Trump's, you know, obviously a boomer, and he doesn't get it at all. He's like the most egocentric man who's ever lived, right? Biden is talked all about his legacy the entire time he's been in charge as another like boomer, silent generation, actually, guy. Obama, same situation. He became obsessed with what he was capable of doing for his place in the history books. And he also, someone who's born in Hawaii, you know, rich his whole life, went to private schools. Aside from exactly Ron DeSantis, who was in the military, served as legal counsel to the SEALs and that sort of thing. So he was kind of like in the shit, at least to a degree.
He's the only veteran I can think of. Tulsi Gabbard.
Tom Cotton, I guess. Wasn't Tom Cotton a veteran? I feel like he was. I'm gonna look that up real quick. Tom Cotton. He likes to send in the troops. So, you know. Is he the kind of guy who sends in? Yep. Oh, yeah. He's a captain in the army. He got a bronze star. So, I mean, someone shot at him at some point. He did it.
Okay.
He enlisted. And then he got into OCS. He did it the hard way.
But
good for him.
And
he was a ranger. Okay. Yeah. Wow. He's legit. I get it. Picture of him with a cat in Iraq in 2006. Looks like a different man.
So I don't want to give the impression that military service is the only way to get in the thick of things.
No, not at all.
Especially since it's so right coded now. You know,
Sherrod Brown, for example, that's someone who's lived some life. He's like a left wing pro labor Democrat, but like he's someone who clearly has labored to achieve his position and understands what regular people go through and understands his position as a leader matters in representing their interests, you know, because he's felt and lived that life himself. But you're going to probably find most of those people in that sort of Rust Belt area, right? Like Tim Ryan struck me as that too, to be honest with you. Like, he also is someone who understood the people he was representing better than most, even if they did not ultimately elect him and instead took the blood-sucking Yale lawyer as predicted. Although he showed up in Cincinnati, by the way.
I almost went to go see him.
He was in town. He lives here, but he's back in town because he had to show back up to get out of jury duty. Yeah, you got a jury duty notice. A little picture, like, here it is. I'm not lying. Here it is. Hamilton County Courthouse. I had to go. I'm like, I can't go. I have orientation for my new job. I'm like, all right, you're out.
So aside from, you know, an N equals one study of Beto O'Rourke, is there anything besides he was completely disconnected from the people that he sought to serve that in your deep dive really struck you? Because I came prepared to talk about why saying in Texas that you're going to take your AR-15 is a bad idea.
There's a lot to be said about how Texas might be able to vote for Democrats, but it's never going to be liberal, and not understanding the difference between small C conservative and big C conservative,
right,
is what will get you there. And yeah, like I was saying from the very start of him talking about running for governor of Texas, like, this is the man who said he attacks churches. Are you fucking kidding me? Like, he's going to lose by whatever number you want to come up with to Greg Abbott. Like, there's no way he can win now. And it's because, you know, otherwise democratically leaning voting Texas voters all still go to church. You know, like that's a cultural thing that you can't undo once you've done, right?
Right.
Like, you just lost too much with that. You can buy some of it back, but not all of it. The guns thing, like, I think that was less damaging, to be honest with you. I think the church thing is probably what fucking killed him before he had a chance to, you know, like, it's what caused his campaign to have SIDS. You know, is the church thing. Like, there's like the guns thing, particularly with the Uvalde shooting, there's an audience for that that's going to be receptive towards, like, I don't like my family being in danger, and they're just gonna accept that message whether I agree with it or not. I get why there's a like an audience for it, but those people go to church.
Yeah,
they do.
You have the ability to flip to operative mode that I don't, where you're like just analyzing, this is the way that the votes are going to break down.
Yeah,
whether I have this ideological prior or not.
I mean, that's why the Ohio Senate race was so easy for us to suss out from the beginning. Like, we said weeks in advance, in the very first conversations we recorded, J.D. Vance is going to win by 8 points. We just knew that. And you knew that because we know how red this state has become.
Right.
We live here. We've seen it. We've seen the change. And the disaffected, like, liberal elite that do live here have been outnumbered forever. And then they're very loud on social media and they make it seem like it's different than it really is. But it's the state voted for Trump for 8 points. J.D. Vance is going to win by 8 points. That's it. Like, especially with Mike DeWine, who's no one's favorite, is going to win by 20. Like, someone tried to point out to me, like, well, no one likes DeWine. None of the conservatives like DeWine in Ohio. And you're like, I know. I live here. I got primary by two guys. Like, and, it, you know, like, if they hadn't split the dissident vote, he might have actually been threatened potentially in that primary. But there were two candidates against him, so they split the not DeWine vote, and he got, like, 48% and won easily. But even though he's no one's favorite, he won by 20. What does that fucking tell you about the electorate here? It's fundamentally quite conservative because it was a bellwether when you had that blue-collar Democrat vote.
Yep.
And that was real. And that was real for decades, where they were small-c conservative but would vote Democrat for labor reasons. It's the same reason Sherrod Brown is a senator here. Because he is a representative. That's why Tim Ryan thought he had a shot at it, because he's from Youngstown. Like, that's a real part of the state. The thing is, Trump broke that, and he broke it forever. Those people will never vote for Democrats ever again, except maybe exactly Sherrod Brown. Only because he's so authentically on their side that he's still going to get their support.
But that's incumbency advantage.
They know him. He goes to them. He's like tight with the unions. He's always talking about things he's trying to do for labor. And because of that, because he's so clearly that's his part of his constituency, they still support him. But Trump destroyed the Rust Belt, small C, blue collar Democrat forever. And it's why he won Michigan, and it's why he won Pennsylvania, and it's why he won Ohio. And I guess a lot of people thought, well, because Michigan and Pennsylvania flipped back, it was like a temporary thing. But no, it's that the margins there were much smaller because those constituencies are smaller in those states, because Ohio is actually where the economic developments occurred over the last 8 years. So our population has grown.
They were also bluer to start with.
Yeah, and our state was a little bit redder to start with, and it has become more red because we still have all of that manufacturing. We still have a lot of those jobs, and we still have a lot of those voters.
So what you're saying is, at the end of the day, no matter who wins the football game, we still beat the Steelers at being Steelers.
I mean, we're not making steel so much as cars, but yes.
Cars are made of steel. It's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're taking their things they're making and then actually turning them into things people want. So we're like them, but better.
Sounds good.
What's your serious topic?
So I wanted to talk about healthcare, and it's not any more specific than that. I just have been thinking about it a lot lately. Healthcare is a problem, and it's a problem for a lot of people in a lot of ways. Let's start with, it's a problem, since this is a political podcast, it seems fair. It's a problem for the GOP. It is a problem that they are the party of not fixing healthcare. Even though I am the furthest thing from an advocate for Medicare for All that exists. The dynamic that people pick up on is Democrats are trying to do something, and Republicans are blocking it. And that's fine if you block it so you can do your thing instead. But when Republicans have power, they just, healthcare's not on the agenda. It's not.
No.
It's not anywhere near it.
What healthcare is supposed to be is expensive as far as they're concerned.
With one notable exception, where give credit where it's due, Trump's executive order about healthcare was pretty good.
Which one was that?
It was something like about price transparency, where hospitals are supposed to post prices. I'm not sure that it's legal, and I'm not sure that that's happened, but I appreciate that he tried.
Yeah, the weird thing to me about American healthcare is the opacity of what you're being charged, what insurance companies will pay, and sort of the weird Mexican standoff that occurs between those two points that you just never see. Especially if you have functional healthcare.
You get like weird looks if you ask what anything's going to cost.
Yeah, like Yeah, it's like, what? Well, I don't know, what's your copay? Like, that's what's going to cost you. Everything else is going to go behind this curtain. We're going to have a knife fight, and you're not going to see it. Like, that's the reason why that system exists is not only do you have this, essentially this pushing, pulling that has to go on between the healthcare providers about what they can get away with, what they can justify as necessary, and how much they can charge for it for each patient to make as much money as possible, versus the insurance company about what they're willing to cover and the Byzantine rules that go from between A and B, and like the using the patient as the football between the two, because like one side doing too much to harm the patient is going to cause the other side to suffer, you know? So like if you go in to receive medical treatment and like you get a test that the insurance company doesn't want to pay for, and the hospital says you need it, otherwise this thing could happen, you know, that's related to your disease, and then you're the soulless, you know, insurance company that won't pay for it, and now it's going to cost $1 zillion to the patient, and now it's become a problem for the insurance company that they haven't covered it, and then I got to go and cover it. But really, did it happen because it had to happen, or did it happen because the healthcare provider knew they get an extra $10,000 out of the insurance company if they like played their leverage, right? Like, no one knows that shit's happening.
And there's this whole game where like the people that know realize that you can just not pay whatever the sticker price is. Like the healthcare company will send you this bill, and for the most part, you can just ignore it. They'll put something on your credit report about how you just ignored this bill. But even, you know, credit reporting companies know that like you got billed $10,000 all of the sudden. That's not indicative of your credit worthiness in any real way. So it's not impacting your credit score that much. So it gets sent off to collections, and they'll try to get whatever the delta between your credit score is actually worth from you.
Yeah.
Like this whole game that's played, and people just see the giant bill in the mail and it freaks them out. And like, this is all ridiculous.
Yeah. Isn't there special rules about healthcare bills about like their level of collectability is lower than most other bills because of this ridiculous, ridiculous inflated cost issue made it so that like you getting a ridiculous house, like, oh, I'm just not going to pay that. So you should probably charge me less if you actually want any money and I can settle this. And that's often what happens, is you get this kind of negotiating period that is very easily to enter into if you know you can.
Yeah. But people just don't know that this game is played, and they really get screwed. So feel bad for those guys. We're trying to help our listeners, I guess.
Oh, and you don't know, or you don't know because you have private insurance. And so you just go in, you like pay the amount that the insurance company says that you owe them for, you know, a copay or whatever. And unless you go to page 2 of that bill and you see the knife fight results about what they charged and what was paid for and what was written off basically by who.
It's a write-off, Jerry.
It's unknown to you, right? You have to really actually dig in to see. And it's an odd system that strangely works, I guess is the way I would put it.
I don't think it works, but so I want to introduce this incredible graph by a data blogger that goes by Random Critical Analysis that shows essentially a linear fit when you take log of a country's income per person, and it shows that the share of spending on healthcare increases with the country's income. And so in low-income country like Mexico, they only spend 7% of their GDP on healthcare. In Norway, they spend 8.7%, and that's the range here, excluding the outliers, goes from 7.4% to 8.8%. That's about how much most countries spend on healthcare. And what this is showing is that as societies get wealthier, they spend more on healthcare partially because they get older because they live longer, and partially because if you're poor, you're more concerned about, you know, food. You're not going to go see a doctor for this little thing. And the third thing that it shows, the third reason, is what's called the Baumol effect. The Baumol effect is this fun piece of economics that's way, way under known as a way that is something that affects how people live.
Mm-hmm.
The Baumol effect says that the economics of abundance, the reason we have so much stuff, only applies to stuff. It does not apply to anything that you need a person to do. So you get rich when one person goes from making 50 widgets to making 100 widgets. But if you need a doctor to be a doctor, you can't, you can like see more patients, but you still need a person to do that.
Right.
So not only does it not get as cheaper as just mass-produced goods get, it gets more expensive because the opportunity cost goes from 50 widgets to 100 widgets. So when you get richer, all these services go way up. It's why it's rarer to have servants than it would have been in like a medieval period, even though we all have more money. You can't just hire someone for nothing because they'll go do something else. They can do better things with their time.
Labor is so expensive now, you can't afford to have a servant the way you could if you were middle class in the 1600s.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. No, that makes a lot of sense. And it does explain the rise in costs of healthcare because it takes not just a person, but a extremely well-trained and credentialed person to provide healthcare. And the cartels set up within their education system to limit the amount of practitioners such that those that do graduate are guaranteed princely incomes for life, thus justifying the enormous loans that they've taken out for that education. It just all makes so much sense. Everyone's getting paid in the end. Everyone. The doctors, the medical organizations that enforce the rules, the schools that abide by them and take all of the loan money that these doctors are will-be doctors are taking out. Yeah. And the doctors themselves, because the same rules applying behind them, defend their income in the moment.
Yes.
If there's all of a sudden a whole bunch more doctors are going to graduate, then the value of their labor goes down and they can't afford that because they took out $400,000 in loans.
This podcast maintains its principled anti-cartel stance, whatever the shape of the particular cartel. There are a bunch of rich old people that are going to be buying lots of health. They're going to be throwing money at healthcare. What happens is through restricting doctors and like it's impossible to build a new hospital unless other hospitals agree. Like that's a ridiculous way to run anything. Mm-hmm. So we have all these hard supply constraints. And hard supply constraints meet a bunch of money getting thrown at it. And you end up with, I don't want to say inflation because inflation is a monetary phenomenon, but you get less things for the dollars that you spend in healthcare. And some of that's natural.
Right.
And some of it's not.
I firmly believe that when the real crunch comes in the United States as a consequence of boomers entering the final stages of their lives, which is really what we're talking about, right? Boomers are retiring or finished retiring, or, you know, my dad's a late boomer. He's 65, right? Like they're done, right? They're wrapping it up in terms of the workforce.
And just retiring, they're going into long-term care facilities, which
and that, yeah.
Talk about something that gets Baumol affected is bedpans.
Yeah. The leading edge of the boomers are the ones that are now entering the final stages of their lives. If the youngest are now the ones retiring, right? And as you say, the level of care they're all about to experience needing is the labor intensive, expertise intensive, and was expensive a generation ago. It is going to be ridiculously expensive now, right? Like as they move through the system. It's not built for a cohort of people of their size. And everyone knows that. And there's not enough doctors. There's not enough caregivers. You're going to see a huge demand to import doctors. That's really something the United States has resisted, right? Like if you're a medical practitioner from overseas, you really got to jump through a lot of hoops to be accredited to practice medicine in the United States, right? It's not just as easy as like I got a medical degree in India and I just come over and I start seeing patients. Don't work like that.
Nope.
It's gonna. And there's going to be no choice, right? Like you're just going to be like, we need doctors. We don't have enough people to treat all of these elderly folks plus our normal population who still needs medical care, by the way. And like you said, when all of the money is locked up in your older generations, as it tends to, the only way we, you know, to get through this is that we have to have more supply. And we'll build more supply domestically. There'll be some changes, but it's like that. We're not going to see that for 20 years. So open the floodgates. Find me the finest Indian doctors and bring them here, right? Because we can pay more. We can pay more than any part of the developing world can. That's always our fucking secret sauce, right?
We can pay more than Europe. We can pay more than anybody.
Yeah. So, like, bring them over. Bring them over. Are you a licensed medical practitioner? Here's a simple set of things that you're going to have to pass to practice medicine in the United States. Boom. Got them. Let's do it. You know, like, it's going to happen. The market's going to demand it. There's no way. I mean, there's going to be too much actual human suffering for them to be able to refuse it.
So how do Republicans have a conversation about healthcare without being owned by their lobbyists and actually, like, solve something? Because if there's anything voters would reward with the kind of generational loyalty that used to happen in politics, it would be just fix healthcare. Because everybody knows somebody, or they know somebody who knows somebody that got a $50,000 bill and had, like, serious life consequences, or that stressed and didn't get some procedure. They didn't get something looked at because they didn't want, like, because they knew it would be expensive and suffered a consequence as a result. Like, that is a very common occurrence, and it's going to cost you voters if you keep ignoring it.
Healthcare stress is an almost universal form of anxiety. Everyone has experienced it at some point. And like you said, you would get the permanent support of the entire normie political class if you solved it. I think the Republicans' problem is they're unwilling to solve it because none of the solutions are really market-based, which is really where they start and finish in some respect. And because of that, I think that if you asked a Republican a few beers deep what they think they should do with healthcare, they'd say nothing. Poor people should just die. Like, I don't endorse that view personally, but I think that is the actual belief of if you ask enough, you know, the conservative intelligentsia and be like, some people will not afford the level of care that others can, and they will not live as long as others. And that is simply the way of the universe. You know, some people, get to experience the grandeur of life more than others. So be it.
But that's what makes me so angry, is that there are market solutions. Like, it's not like Heritage isn't putting out papers on the subject. Like, you just reduce the restrictions on supply that we talked about earlier. Singapore's healthcare model does not get nearly enough attention, in my opinion. You can have people pay out of pocket for generic visits. This is a problem that can be solved with a tax cut, which is Republicans' favorite thing in the world, is to solve problems with a tax cut. Just put a massive tax cut on buying your own health insurance instead of getting it through your employer, and you end one of the biggest constraints on our labor market. That's like, people can't change jobs because you can't leave and you won't have health insurance anymore.
You have to fix the bigger system, though, and that's the part where it's going to be impossible, right? Like, that's just deciding to have the government subsidize it, which is what they tried to do with Obamacare, was create a scheme by which the government will subsidize some of the costs of independently getting your own health care such that it can be more generally accessible to people across different income strata. And it's hated by the right because it is that. It is just a subsidy for people to get health care, you know, at a low to no cost, or expand Medicaid or anything like that. The part of the system that needs to be broken is the insurance companies, because they're such a gatekeeper towards this payer-payee process. We've already talked a bit about how there's a supply issue when it comes to actual medical professionals, and why that exists, and why the incentives are set up where that's a problem. But then you have the insurance companies themselves, who have made an industry out of risk assessment and taking payments and figuring out the best ways to fight with medical professionals about what gets paid and what doesn't and at what percentages. It's just a giant algorithm that has been built piece by piece that they have mastered to just make money off this scheme, right?
But that's fine. That can still exist. Other even countries with like a Britain has private health insurers. It's just on top of basic care coverage.
Well, yeah, they have health insurance so that like you don't have to wait 6 months to be seen by a doctor in the NHS, right? Like they're just paying for health coverage because the base level sucks.
I'd be remiss if I didn't note that employer provided health insurance is also subsidized. It's pre-tax that's paid. It's a taxless benefit that you can give to employees on like their income. So that that's already you'd just be bringing up individual bought insurance to its own to a level playing field.
My ideal circumstance to fix this, if I was dictator and I could just do what I wanted, you would destroy health insurance as a thing. It just wouldn't exist anymore. Okay.
Why? Smoking should make your health insurance more expensive. That like insurance is a good thing in general.
But instead create a system by which you negotiate directly for, you know, there's first price transparency for all medical things. Lots of price transparency, direct negotiation with providers, and schemes to set up healthcare savings as a both thing you can do independently, something the government can partially encourage through tax benefits, and that the employer can also be involved with to provide as well, such that like you're setting up a reserve of economic, you're setting up a reserve of resources to cover your healthcare costs that you now have available to you transparently that are being negotiated directly with the providers, and also end the blockade on providers. Like open up the ability, you know, open up more ability for providers to come onto the market, so that will instantly create price competition that will keep the price as low as possible for the consumer. Like those are all the things you have to do, right? More providers, more hospitals, you know, more transparency, and a system by which you are advantaged for preparing for the need to engage with that system at some point in the future.
You still have to have insurance play a role, though. Like, you're going to get six-figure bills if you get cancer over the course of a bunch of treatments that no amount of health savings account can prepare you for. Like, there is tail risk that has to be insured.
And maybe there is a catastrophic level care that insurance that you can purchase, or even that can be like a public option element just for catastrophic care of like, here is your downside risk thing that you can buy into for these, like really, like you got cancer, you had a heart attack level issues, you know?
And that's exactly right. Is healthcare, health insurance as it exists now is completely backwards. Like you pay the regular costs and then the caps are too low to be meaningful in the case of actual catastrophes. What it should be is you should pay your regular costs. If you're going to a doctor on a visit that you scheduled, there's no reason to involve an insurance company. That is not a risk that can be insured. That's just a recurring thing that you have to pay for.
Right.
What insurance is for large catastrophic risks.
I do firmly believe that like insurance as the cartel we understand it now just should be completely shattered and broken and moved to the side as part of the solution. I think that is just a system that's generating an economic rent on people, both on both sides of the equation for their own shareholders. And it does not serve any purpose whatsoever if you could rebuild the system in every other possible way to create the circumstances in which it would no longer be necessary. All the money the insurance companies make could be better purposed towards providers and the ability to pay for the care they provide.
But you've done the math on what states you just can't include if part of your plan is fight the insurance companies.
Oh, I didn't have to be dictator, bro. Like, I had this conversation with a friend of mine, and actually, it's a mutual friend of ours from Magic, and he is a dyed-in-the-wool super Bernie bro who for a long time was convinced that Medicare for all could happen, right? Like, this was a thing that could pass in Congress. And I had to explain to him, how do you think you would get this passed in the Senate? Because you need 60 votes, right? So tell me how you get to 60 votes in a Democrat-controlled Senate with no senators from New York, Connecticut, Illinois, and California. Because those are the states where one of the top five industries is insurance. Like, tell me how you get to 60 votes without eight Democrat senators who will never vote for it. He's like, oh, I never thought of it that way. I was like, of course you didn't. Like, you've never been to Connecticut. You've never been to Hartford, Connecticut. You don't know that that is a city built on insurance. Like, never been to Chicago. Like, you don't know these things.
So in the world of what we can do, I think the step zero, got to get rid of those supply restrictions.
Yeah.
I think Republicans love a problem they can solve with a tax cut. I think you bring the privately bought health insurance up to as subsidized as the employer provided, because that has spillover effects that make our labor market worse. Healthcare just the best quote about healthcare is there are dozens of theories of why the market's screwed up and all of them are correct.
They're all right.
But it frustrates me because it's such a political dead weight, and it doesn't have to be.
I do think, like many things, I'm fond of saying, it doesn't change without crisis. We haven't had crisis yet. I think we are entering into a period where crisis will occur, and that might cause change to have to happen. It typically takes that, right? Like, until the catastrophic event comes thundering down upon you, you know, it's all, why change the status quo? Right. And right now it works. And then soon it won't. And when it doesn't, that's when it will change. And that'll be your opportunity to change it. Right. Like, that's when everyone's like, whatever ideas people have, let's get to it. Right. Like, what do we got in the book? Let's go for it.
The largest asterisk around it works, because for a lot of people, it doesn't.
It works for me.
It works for the class that can afford lobbyists.
And that too. And if you're interested in why we call ourselves replacement level morality, we demand you tweet that at us at some point, or tweet it at Andrew specifically. Or you can email us at replacementlevelmorality@gmail.com, or otherwise prove that, you know, the dozens of you who are apparently listening want to know the answer. And we'll let you know when we speak to you next week.